Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithelday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great ATQ writers, Badwater. How you doing?
Doing okay. 2023 is still trying to find new and clever ways to trip me up, but I'm still upright, so can't complain.
Well, it's March. We're going to be talking about March Madness, and also the Diamond Ducks are getting into swing. You can cover in baseball for us. The Ducks have had three out-of-conference series. All of them have been sweeps, and two of them even in the right way. Most recently, they swept the San Diego Toreros. You covered that for the site. What were your takeaways from that series?
Well, it kind of goes back to the beginning of the season where this baseball team has kind of started on footing that they really didn't want to be on, you know, losing RJ Gordon pretty much for the season right from the outset. And then it looked like Isaac Am was going to be out for initially they were saying most of the season, but I noticed Coach Waz is he was a little bit more cautiously optimistic about Aeon's return, and it looks like he's on a series-to-series basis. You know, when he comes back, he comes back. But you know, in the meantime, we've had to depend on an overwhelmingly freshman pitching staff. And they've done pretty well. I don't think most Oregon baseball fans know that out of the 16 pitchers on Oregon staff that have pitching statistics, they've pitched in game, 10 of them are freshmen. True freshmen. I mean, that's an overwhelmingly young pitching staff. And that they've performed as they have is just nothing short of incredible.
Yeah, I mean, in their most recent game, you know, against San Diego, you know, first of all, they did really well. You know, they only gave up one run, you know, in the second inning, and basically like no hits. You know, like, you know, it wasn't until pretty late in the game that, you know, I think they went through like five innings without giving up a hit in the middle of the game, but they kept rotating through pitchers, and it was like freshman after freshman after freshman. It was like people I'm like relearning this team, you know. It's a lot of new faces, and especially on the mound.
Yeah, and it's all because we're not familiar with these freshman pitchers. You know, pitchers like Jackson Pace and Leo Ullman have really shown their stuff, and they've kind of stepped up where they've had to, because we don't have as much of a veteran pitching staff as we would have, you know, if we had Gordon or Aeon. So, you know, they've had to step up. They have, and they've pitched pretty darn good. You know, Pace had a great outing against San Diego. You know, just pitched six solid innings. You can't be disappointed about that at all.
I was actually, you know, during what was looking like, you know, he might have been a shutout. Like I was wondering whether or not Waz was going to leave him in the entire game, try to get the whole thing. You know, he didn't. But you know, that's the other thing that's been encouraging to watch for this baseball team is that, like, you know, even with the, you know, the pitching injuries that you've mentioned, like, Waz is very comfortable pulling, you know, like there was a point, I can't remember if it was the game three or game four against the Toreros, but like, you know, one of the batters, like one of the pitchers, like hit a batter, and it was like it was a mound conference immediately. You know, like, and the pitcher was gone, you know, like, you know, next inning he was gone, you know, like there was none of this, like, well, let's see if he pitches his confidence back, you know, like, nah, it was none of this. It was just like, we got like six other guys, you know, come on.
They're not going to necessarily have a feel for live gameplay from most of these freshmen. So, you know, they're going to be on a short leash, and even if they're doing very well, you know, was going to be thinking about matchups. And, you know, there's, I'm sure there's a handful of them that are just on limited pitches. They're on a pitch count, and they're kind of easing them into, you know, college play, because it's a different game from high school.
And it's not like San Diego is a bad hitting team either. In fact, statistically, they have the best hitter in the nation, right? Or, you know.
Yep. Yeah. You can't say enough about how the pitching staff all around performed, you know, in getting a sweep. And, you know, like I say, it's impossible not to be impressed with these freshmen. And I hope it's going to continue coming up into Pac-12 play against some pretty good Pac-12 teams.
And then I also like, you know, boy, the long ball, you know, the bats are really coming alive. A lot of home runs, you know, during this series, including Nishida putting up a home run with a wood bat.
Yeah,
that was really crazy. Like seeing that. That was cool.
Yeah, it was. I don't think I've ever seen that in a college game, but yeah, the word from somebody that I read was that he asked if it was legal, and you know, it's legal to do something. That's what he did, and yeah, pop one over the fence.
I mean, you could. I mean, I was watching that game live, and I, you can hear it. You can hear it with a wood bat. I was like, number one, you can hear it when it's a home run, like, you know, and number two is you can hear it when it's a wood bat. It's like, oop, he got that one. And I mean, I think it was the first hit of the game. Like,
yeah. And it's funny how,
bats, I mean, technically it's not a hit, but you know what I mean? Right. Like, I think it was the first time an Oregon batter connected with the ball. And I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah. It's kind of funny how you can watch a Major League Baseball game, college football, Major League Baseball game, college baseball game, and you get used to the sound of the bats as a background noise. So somebody goes hitting it out of PK Park with a wooden bat. Yep, that doesn't go with the background noise. Gets your attention. But it wasn't just the home run stuff. The Ducks were really productive with RBI doubles. You know, especially Drew Cowley. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a couple of those doubles on successive days, two RBI doubles that were placed in almost virtually the same place in left field. It's pretty incredible.
Well, yeah, I mean, the third game where they just blew him out, they just like couldn't stop hitting home runs. I mean, it was just crazy, you know, like, you know, it was like single, double home run, single, double home run. It was just like, I mean, it got crazy. And then the fourth game was funny because it was like, you know, first three innings was a home run apiece. And then sort of a, you know, scoring drought into the seventh, and, you know, in which Oregon put him in danger zone, you know, like, but it was like really good base running, you know, it was like a stand up stolen base, they put runners on the corner, stand up stolen base to put them on second and third. And then just a, you know, like you said, Cowley, just a real nice, you know, single, you know, to drive home two dudes to, you know, to put the game away, you know, 5-1, where it was just, you know, it was base running, you know, it's just athleticism, you know, like, and we've talked about this, you know, I know we've talked about this with the softball team, but it's true the baseball team as well. It's like, you know, Oregon tends to have an athletic advantage, you know, where, you know, this sort of stuff, like, you know, look, it's tertiary compared to power hitting, you know, on base percentage and pitching, you know, it's true, but, you know, fielding and athleticism to squeeze out, you know, to squeeze out extra runs in scoring position and, or to put yourself in scoring position and to conversely not have those marginal, you know, scoring opportunities go against you because you're winning double plays, et cetera, with your fielding. Like, yeah, that's how you like squeeze out, you know, games against, you know, that are tight games or against like evenly matched competition. And, you know, yeah, it's nice to see that out of the Ducks. And as I said, you know, we're sort of learning a bunch of new faces with this young team. And yeah, you know, Oregon's not missing a beat, you know, on that question. I can definitely report from watching that, you know, this series, you know, and I watched every one of these games and you wrote up every one of these games, just like, yeah, Oregon's got a lot of really athletic baseball players and like, you know, they know their base running, you know, they know how to put themselves in a scoring position, take advantage when they're in it.
Yeah. And with some of these close games that we've seen, the pitching staff is really helped by some outstanding defensive play. You know, over this last series, we saw some great, outfield outs, double plays, just in insane, infield stops. So, and that, yeah, that's what a young pitcher is going to need to, you know, kind of help them make it through the inning.
Well, they stay here in Eugene, this coming weekend. They start Pac-12 play against number 13 ranked UCLA, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Should be a pretty good matchup. UCLA is also a very athletic team. It'll be on Oregon live stream, so you can watch it on your computer or go to the park. Weather should be okay. Apparently the Oregon sports or a scorekeeper has been doing fun stuff. If you look up the if you go to the box score, they've been commenting there was a rain delay for the fourth game for a few minutes, and the official weather report from the scorekeeper for game four against San Diego is not kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the first game, it was the weather report was me no likey.
All right. Let's take a break. We come back. We'll talk some men's hoops. Well, Oregon needed to sweep the Bay Area schools in order to beat out Arizona State for a first round bye at the Pac-12 tournament. And that is just what happened. They handled Cal pretty easily. Cal is a 3-win team on the season. So that was a comfort.
Yes.
In fact, the box score is actually not very helpful against Cal. It's like, you know, I do film analysis for the football team, and you know, it's pretty common for advanced statisticians to incorporate what we call garbage time, and basketball has not caught up with us. We need garbage time to analyze this box score. Like, you know, there are guys playing significant minutes in this game who never play. Like, you know, like a lot of the shot percentage is inaccurate or non-representative because there are dudes hoisting buckets who never take shots. Like, it was bad, man. like, I don't know if we can glean much out of this game. Poor Cal. No. I'm not really sure what Cal is good at, you know, to be honest. Like, I was trying to go through like what's, you know, rowing, I guess, like esports, maybe like Cal's Dota 2 team has got to be phenomenal. That's about it as far as I can tell. Rugby. They've got to have a really good rugby team, or at least they all wear rugby shirts to their football games. So,
maybe they still do wrestling.
Unlike Oregon, sadly, they killed it off in order to have baseball, I guess.
Yeah. I can live with that.
The Stanford game, though, they needed to get that one. It was like closer than it should have been because Stanford's not really that much better of a team. You know, just looking at the box score, you know, Stanford dropped a couple more 3-pointers than they should have. They probably got a little luckier behind the 3-point arc. You know, that they went 9 for 21 from the 3-point line, probably should have been more like 7 for 21, which case, that, you know, it would have been instead of, you know, 68-73, it would have been 62-73, you know, in other words, an 11-point win, and nobody would have batted an eye. So, like, I don't know. I'm not sure how much anybody ought to be panicking about this, you know, game. You know, you can just sort of write it off to, like, Stanford got lucky a couple of times from the three-point arc. But I don't know, man. What do you think about this team? We're all done with the regular season. They did get a first-round bye at the Pac-12 tournament. All is well. Is that what you're thinking about this team?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they did pick up a couple of troubling injuries before the Stanford game, and they at this point they really can't afford to lose players. Hopefully, hopefully the injury bug stops there, because at the moment where it looks like in this season, they might be starting to figure this out. They don't need to drop players to injury, because that's just going to upset the apple cart. So they're coming against the Cougars or Cal. Well, let's just say they're coming against
Cougars. The Cougars. Yeah, oh my God.
Because I heard Krepea saying, and this was a week or two ago, that Cal was statistically the worst Power Five basketball team.
It'd be hard to imagine a worse one.
Yeah. So, so we'll be going against the Cougars, and hopefully we have
the Cougs. Oh. As in all sports, are a little worrisome to play in Pullman. I guess I don't really worry about them too much in a neutral site. Although the women's team just won.
Yeah, the women went all the way
through. You know, we stopped paying attention to them when Oregon got beat by Stanford, which, you know, we all expected, you know, for that to happen. But, like, actually there were a bunch of crazy upsets on the women's side. Like, both, you know, all the favorites lost. Utah and Stanford went out in both of their first games. Mm-hmm. The women's side was actually pretty crazy in the Pac-12 tournament, and good for the Cougs, the Lady Cougs, the first time ever, I believe, won on the women's side, and not in Pullman. So I guess they can play outside of the Palouse. Nonetheless,
I hope so, you know, I hope that fairy dust doesn't settle over on the men's side.
I feel like, you know, they probably used it up. I don't know. Like, I watched, you know, that was the third of a three-game skid on the men's side, you know, that Oregon lost to. But, you know, one was UCLA. One was Washington that was truly painful, and maybe the nadir of Will Richardson's just like, Will, I mean, give me a break, dude. And then the Wazoo game was sort of the last of them, and I don't know, man. Like, I feel like if the Wazoo game happened in isolation, it, like, people wouldn't have been freaking out about it as much, because it really just felt like just one of those games that, like, if you watched it in isolation, it felt like one of those games where the other team just sort of got hot with a couple of lucky shots and the home team just won, you know, a game that they shouldn't have. Like, it really, like, and it was only that it was part of that skid that made it, you know, feel so bad and like inexorable and awful or whatever. Like, if you actually break down the box score, you know, and treat it like it, as its own thing statistically, it's sort of like, it's not that scary. And Wazoo is not that scary of a team. And honestly, like, Oregon's performance against Stanford was not that scary, but, you know, Oregon's performance against Stanford sort of like continues these, like, I don't know, these like troubling trends. Like, I don't know. For example, like I continue to question why Revoltus Wars is starting on this team. You know, he plays 29 minutes. He shoots three times and makes one basket. You know, I don't, you know, meanwhile, Key Bartholomew and Quincy Guerrier, you know, are playing off the bench and are, you know, massively outscoring him. Kalel Ware, who publicly, you know, is feuding with Dana Altman for a good chunk of the season, like, almost doubles up Rivaldo Soares on 9 minutes of play. Like, it's like, I don't.
How much more do you have to prove, right?
I don't get it. On the other hand, I do like that Nate Biddle is playing more. You know, I like what he's contributing to the team. I want to see more out of Cousinard. Like, when Cousinard is hot, Cousinard is one of the best players in the league, but he's not always real hot. Mm-hmm. Like in Folly Dante, how have we been talking this long? We haven't mentioned Folly Dante, you know, first team Pac-12, like, and he deserves it. Like, I really think that dude's having a great season, and I really wish the rest of the team was like living up to what he's been doing this year.
The Ducks would be totally lost if it wasn't for Dante and his playing right now. And you and I know it. The basketball world knows it. The American people know it.
Yes, certainly.
But I mean, I think the Washington weekend was kind of a lost weekend. You know, that we were seeing a team that was still not congealing very well. And so my hope is that some of that solidification that we've seen the past couple of three games will carry over. Because they need to get at least past their second round game against WSU.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, I realize what I'm about to say sounds pretty squishy and not very like me as an analyst, but like, I do think that I've been seeing that the last couple of games, you know, more cohesive play, like more play as a team. You know, like, hell, it could just be they're playing against, you know, inferior opponents, you know, but like, I really don't. Yeah. You know, like, for a lot of like cynical people, like cynical Ducks fans or fans of other fan bases who are just, you know, out for blood, you know, out for any excuse to say or have this line locked and loaded, whether it's true or not, you know, want, you know, Dana Altman's reign of terror over the Pac-12 to be over, you know, want Dana Altman to have lost his touch. Like, when I watch this team, I don't see a team that's badly coached. I do see curious decision about starting time or you know, starter with sores. I don't get that. You know, I see an allegiance to Will Richardson, which I don't, you know, at this point looks like a bad bet, but like, he doesn't have a time machine. But like, the idea that like this team is uncohesive and not coming together in March the way that Dana Altman teams have historically done, so that he has a chance to continue the 20 win streak. I don't see evidence of that at all. Like, right. Not even a little bit.
Right. And it's going to be very interesting to see, provided that the Cougars, don't become the women's team and blow through everybody. It would be very interesting to see how this team plays against UCLA, because that's going to be kind of the litmus test of whether they can be taken seriously for an NCAA berth or not, either an at-large situation, or, you know, if you can beat UCLA, well then, yeah, maybe the tournament champion position is where you're going.
Honestly, it would be the most Dana Altman thing ever to beat UCLA to get win number 20. Mm-hmm. Like, and also like, just like the UCLA fan base screaming about that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You could power a small city for a year with the amount of UCLA fan base.
They go totally atomic.
Screaming and garment rending over that.
Well, UCLA in a couple of years, this won't be your problem.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Oregon's new offensive line coach. So the once and future offensive line coach, Alik Terry, was actually a grad assistant for Oregon in 2019 and 2020. working with the offensive line. He was an offensive line player for Wake Forest. And then, he graduated, then was a, quality control guy, for his, alma mater. Then Oregon picked him up as a GA, in 2019, 2020. So like he was actually working with these guys. Like he's not so old that like, this is a new crop. Like some of these guys were guys he was working with already. So then Hawaii actually picks him up to be their offensive line position coach. His first on-field job is with Hawaii in 2021. And that was the film that I reviewed for the article that I will be publishing tomorrow morning. We're recording this on Tuesday night. And this podcast will go out like half an hour before this article, I guess. I reviewed Hawaii's season with Elik Terry as the offensive line coach. Hawaii's 2021 season was kind of cursed. Todd Graham, who Oregon fans may remember was Arizona State's coach for a while there. He was like Pitt's head coach and Tulsa's head coach and a couple other places. He resigned/was fired by Hawaii at the end of that season. It came out that there were a bunch of players who were, who felt like really mistreated, by him, and his staff. Todd Graham hired his son, Bo Graham, to be the offensive coordinator. I can tell you from watching film in 2021, I hated that offense. I really did not like doing this project. I didn't like watching this film because the offense was not good. Like, or it was a 6-7 team in which I felt like the offense was. You know how fans will complain about offenses being like uncreative and totally predictable, and like they just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, and really they're actually not, they're just not executing particularly well, but like fans don't want to say that, they want to blame the coaches. You know how fans make that complaint?
All they do is they run and they pass, and then three downs and out. That's the complaint of just about any fan base where the team isn't doing
so well. Fans would actually be correct about this team. Like this, this team, watching this offense made me wish that like John Donovan or Andy Ludwig were the offensive coordinator, because those guys look like creative geniuses playing with a full deck compared to what Bo Graham was doing. It was so, now it wasn't run, occasional pass. It was actually the opposite of that. It was tons of drop back passing all the time. In that sense, it was reversed, but that was it, man. It was like all it was doing was drop back passing. They would abandon the run for wide swaths, even though they were actually a pretty effective rushing offense. Their two leading running backs rushed for 6.4 yards per carry and 5.3 yards per carry, which are both, good averages. Between those two guys, they had four different 100-yard games. But the playbook kept shrinking. Like they kept pulling plays out of it. The entire back half of the season, they stopped running. I'm not joking about this. They stopped running outside of garbage time, because they didn't chart garbage time. They stopped running RPOs. They stopped running any kind of play that had a quarterback run as a component to it, which meant any kind of zone read play or design quarterback keeper, or quarterback power. They pulled out sweeps, and they pulled out, you're not going to believe me when I say this, they pulled out screen passes. They did not throw screen passes in the second part of the season. It was nothing but simple downfield passes. Like on a 3-1 basis, like it was such an insipid offense.
So with that kind of thing going on, doesn't that limit your ability to analyze what's going on with the offensive line?
Well,
or is that not the case?
It limit, yes. Destroy, no. It constrains it, and it means that I have to put a grain of salt or like an asterisk next to certain things. So, you know, I do have to put an asterisk next to, I can't promise that this, you know, while I thought that the run game was very promising, I simply don't have a big enough data set to say, you know, that the run blocking was really, really good. I think it looked pretty good, but it just sample size, not big enough. So that's, you know, more on the lines of it's suggestive, not conclusive. I have no idea how good they are at, you know, like for at certain plays like wide zone blocking, because they weren't doing wide zone blocking. I don't know how good they are at power run blocking. They didn't do power run blocking. I don't know how they are at like running downfield on screen. You know, like tunnel screens where the offensive linemen have to run downfield real fast. No clue, because they weren't doing that. Like, on the other hand,
let me ask you this, if I may. How seasoned was that Hawaii front line?
They were third and fourth years, okay. Basically. They had been in the program for a while. They, not under Terry, of course. Terry came to them, you know, for that first year. But you know, you weren't talking about kiddos. What I can tell you, however, is I got to watch a million reps of them doing drop back pass pro, because that's all they were doing. And you know what the strength of Hawaii's offense was? You know, far and away the best thing that Hawaii did was, it wasn't catch passes, because the receivers had rocks for hands. It wasn't the quarterback, because he was making dumb decisions all the time. It might have been the running backs, but they never were given an opportunity to shine. It wasn't the tight end, because, you know, that guy was built like a stick. You know, it wasn't the play calling, because that was made me want to gouge my eyes out. You know what the strength of the offense was?
And that only leaves one unit.
It was the offensive line. It was pretty damn good in pass protection. It was between an 11 and 16%, you know, error rate, which is pretty decent as these things go. You know, it would have been in 2021. It would have been in the top half of the Pac-12. I really like their left tackle. I put a couple of clips in my article in which I'm highlighting the left tackle as like teaching tape. Like, this is how you do it, kids. They really communicate well. Like I put a bunch of clips in my article in which opposing defensive lines do twists and stunts and including like double twists and blitzes and stuff where it's like, it's advanced stuff. It's like where they have to communicate to like handoff assignments, right? It's not just like, take the dude who's coming right at you. It's like, take that dude and then hand him off to that dude while you take this other dude, or you have to know that the back is going to take that dude. So he's eye candy. He's supposed to distract you, but you're not supposed to get distracted. You're going to supposed to take this other guy. Right. And so it's like, there's clips up and down my article of the offensive lineman being smart and not getting fooled by the eye candy and trusting, you know, that everybody knows what their assignment is and that, you know, no, you do this and you do that. And, you know, like they communicate well and like, all, like, yeah, man, the offensive line was the best part of the team. And so like, yeah. That was cool. That was, you know, hey,
I've kind of had your article asterisked in my head when I saw it on the schedule, because I know virtually nothing about Terry, and he's getting a front line where, you know, a lot of the veterans have turned over, and you know, now they're looking at Sunday ball, and so yeah, I'm really very interested in seeing what you're seeing.
Well, you know, like I said, the you know, he was only with Hawaii for 1 year, and he's a pretty young coach. And on top of that, like almost immediately after hiring Terry, he also hires as an offensive line analyst, which is not an on-field coach. Mike Kavanaugh, or I know his last name is Kavanaugh. I hope his first name is Mike. I think that's right. Who's a long time offensive line coach. Like a long time, like that dude's been around forever. He was with Oregon State under Mike Riley, and then Riley took him to Nebraska, and like Nebraska fans speak pretty highly of him there too. He's been all over the place. Like he's been around so long that I didn't even bother to do. I thought about doing a film study project on him. I'm just like, I'm not going to review 30 years of film. I'm just like, this guy's been around for a long time. He knows what he's doing. Let's just like take that on faith. You know, like
right.
I'm sure that he will provide lots of sage advice. But back to Terry, here's my point is that like, apparently, given that, and like I included in my article, a link to the San Francisco Gate article, which simultaneously the San Francisco Gate was the article in which all of these players at Hawaii went to spill the tea, you know, to talk about like all the abusive treatment that they felt that they were receiving at the hands of that coaching staff. Now they talked about Todd Graham a lot. Nobody talked about Ali Terry. Now I can't say, hey, Ali Terry sheltered his players from the bad, you know, culture at that program. And that's why his dudes performed well and nobody and the rest of the dudes didn't. Like I can't say that. Like I have absolutely no way of demonstrating that, whatsoever. I also can't say, hey, this dude who was there for 1 year, who was dealing with kids who, you know, had been in the program longer than he was there, that he turned them into maulers. And before that, they were, you know, lumps of clay who were useless. I have no way of demonstrating that either. And I doubt it's true. But what I can say is on a program that was going downhill fast and which players were willing to spill the tea. And the other thing about that San Francisco Gate article is that it was updated to include Todd Graham's resignation letter in which he mea culpas, man. Like he says some stuff, in which like that program clearly had some toxic elements to it. Like Ali Terry sure didn't do anything wrong. You know, for a guy who's been coaching for a hot second, he sure, you know, in an environment where things could have gone really wrong if he weren't a good dude, things didn't go wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, instead things seemed to go pretty well, you know, and from what I can say from watching films, I was actually pretty impressed. You know, now, did they hit the Oregon standard of single digit error rate? No. You know, that's what I can say from watching a film on Oregon and the Pac-12 and lots of other teams, you know, for a long time now, doing full season, you know, reviews of, you know, I have combined 100 years now. I actually went back and computed this. I've done more than 100 full seasons of film review. I'm 100 years old, but, you know,
pull out the cray.
Yeah. But I have more than 100 full seasons of film review under my belt and you know, with this same system of evaluating, you know, players, including offensive line. And I, you know, I'm able to compare what are my offensive line grades versus, you know, what is your performance? And I can run a correlation analysis on that. And, you know, I'm able to say like, okay, this is what, you know, your offensive line performance needs to be in order for what your overall offensive performance and, you know, your then therefore overall, you know, end of year performance, team performance needs to be. And so basically, you know, I can say with a very high degree of confidence, like extremely high confidence interval, that your offensive line is the most essential aspect to your football team success. Other than your quarterback's performance, that should probably go without saying. Your offensive line performance is extremely important. You know, like defense, like comes in four, like it's, you know, offensive line, do not neglect it. And on top of that, unlike the quarterback and coaching staff, which you can parachute in year one, right? Like you can immediately turn around those positions. You cannot immediately turn around your offensive line. If you dig yourself a hole in the offensive line, it's going to take you 5 years to dig it out, which is why I freak out about offensive line changes. It's why, you know, maybe people wonder what is losing, you know, sanity here. Like, why'd you dig so far into Hawaii's film for this offensive line coach? Well, this is why. Is because if you find yourself in a hole in the offensive line, you are never coming out. And if anybody's wondering why, you know, the Pac-12 has problems, because the Pac-12 doesn't play offensive line very, very well. And if anybody's wondering why the Oregon has more or less, you know, for most of the last 20 years run the Pac-12, it's because Oregon's been the exception. You know, Steve Greatwood and Alex Mirabal, and I guess Adrian Clem, have been the exception in producing excellent offensive lines. And the Oregon standard, and I mean, back to, you know, what I can say from having all this charting and running the correlation analysis, is you need to perform at a single digit error rate across your offensive line in order to get championship caliber performance out of your offense.
I love the form numbers.
And
you just can't argue with it.
So Hawaii was not hitting single digit error rates. Hawaii was at best hitting about 11%. That was their left tackle and their center were hitting 11%. Their left guard was hitting 12%. Their right tackle was unfortunately hitting 16%. He was playing the entire year. I think there were talent problems there, unfortunately. And then the right guard had the right guard. There was an injury problem. He actually started out pretty well, and then he got hurt. And then his backup, it was a backup. And then they rushed the starter. They thought he was healthier than I think he actually was, and they rushed him back in, I think, a week earlier than they should have, and that really hurt his numbers. But then by the end of the season, he did get back to health, and then his numbers come back up. So like that's a complicated situation. His numbers are kind of, you got to put an asterisk next to them. But I can't say the left side of the line actually really played pretty well, and came pretty close to hitting that single digit standard. But the other thing I can say from watching it is that, like, it was, when they were getting beat, it wasn't like mental stuff. It wasn't like technique stuff. You know, it's not the kind of stuff that reflects coaching. It was just like, oh shit, man, that dude just got ran over. Like he just got, you know, out physicaled. You know, they did play two Power Five teams. They played UCLA and Oregon State at the beginning of the year. And like, yeah, it kind of dragged their numbers down a bit. They're playing Power Five guys, not like Oregon State and UCLA have fantastic Power Five defenses in 2021 or anything, but you know what I mean.
That's like, still Power Five.
I mean, hey, they beat, you know, Hawaii beat Fresno State last year. Hey, here's a fun stat. Mario Cristobal beat Kalen DeBoer in 2021. Alik Terry beat Kalen DeBoer in 2021. Dan Lanning lost to Kalen DeBoer in 2022. So, hey, how about that? Maybe that's why Dan Lanning hired Alik Terry.
Hey, you didn't have the right dude.
Yeah.
Right. So, there should be hope against Washington this year.
Yeah.
I hate losing to the Huskies. God, right. I hate that.
Everyone does.
Well, it goes without.
So anyway, I suffered through watching a really insipid offense for a team that wound up firing its entire coaching staff, including Alik Terry, but that's because they, you know, they fired everybody. Terry actually wound up with the Minnesota Vikings as an assistant defensive line coach of all things, which is really interesting. I didn't really feel like it'd be productive to study that, so I didn't. But yeah, you know, offensive line coach now for Oregon. That article is going up tomorrow. Plenty of film clips to look at. I always like doing offensive line stuff because it gives me an opportunity to do a little bit of what I feel is a little educational work, try to teach a little technique. You know, the offensive line, like I said, is the most important, but also most like overlooked unit on a football team. And I feel like it's the thing that most benefits fans doing off season, like film review, where you can like, hey man, every one of these clips, you can slow it down. You can do it in like slow motion. You know, you can even do frame by frame, I believe, on these gifts, like and really watch technique and be like, hey, this is an art form, and pick up like, you know, the subtleties of what's going on here. And like, yeah, I think there's a lot to appreciate, and I think that Terry did a pretty good job, and I think it was pretty encouraging.
Yeah, and even though it's going to be very vanilla, it's going to be interesting to see what the offensive line does with fundamentals during the spring game.
Yeah, that's true.
That's going to be our first opportunity to really kind of dig into how things are going.
That's true. And I mean, it helps. It's not like, you know, Terry's inheriting a bunch of, you know, totally green players. He's getting Jackson Powers Johnson and Marcus Harper and Stephen Jones and, you know, some pretty
and
Connerly, you know, all of whom, you know, got plenty of experience, plus, you know, a bunch of like highly recruited guys like, you know, David Yulee and you know, several other dudes, you know, who you know, been beneficiary of excellent offensive line recruiting for several years at Oregon. So, you know, he's going to be, you know, getting some good guys to work with. You know, he's not walking into, you know, sort of a disaster area. I mean, honestly, you know, it was interesting because this is now the second straight year that I've done a new offensive line coach article. When I wrote up Adrian Clem last year, I also had to touch on like, hey, there are allegations of abuse here. Although the one about Adrian Clem, it was about Adrian Clem. You know, Clem was a much more, was also, you know, Clem was a weird article to write because it was like, hey, I didn't like watching these guys' technique. Like, there were significant problems here, but now all of these dudes are in the NFL. Like, and how do you square that circle? You know, and the best, yeah, like, way that I could figure out was that, like, there were a couple of different theories. You know, basically, it was like, this guy's got a really good eye for evaluation. But like either, you know, while like something was when he took over that program, that like it was such a mess that he had to like rush guys onto the field and like their development was stunted. And that sort of like created problems throughout the time that he was at UCLA, and that, you know, and that was reflected on the field, and that, you know, that maybe when he got to Oregon, when he stepped into, you know, into a situation where it was more like a conveyor belt, you know, it was rather than stepping into a dysfunctional system and trying to whip it into shape, that he was stepping into a functional system and he was just keeping it moving, that, you know, that ladder would, he'd be more successful. And it appeared to be, you know, hey, that theory seemed to hold water. So now I write this article about Terry and I sort of feel like, hey, something similar obtains, you know, here where it's like, hey, Hawaii was a pretty apparently dysfunctional place under Todd Graham, but I liked watching this film, or at least watching this offensive line film, better than I liked watching the UCLA film under Clem, because the UCLA film under Clem, I felt like I was watching technique errors all the time. And when I was watching the Hawaii film under Terry, I felt like I was not watching technique errors. I was watching the offense screw up in every other conceivable way. In fact, literally the first video clip compilation in my article is I had fun assembling this one. I had to give myself some fun after this torture session, struggle session. The first clip compilation in my article is here are four clips of the offensive line doing a fantastic flipping job against a really tough situation, like really tough attack, and then everybody else on the field screwing up for a while. I enjoyed watching this offensive line film more than I enjoyed watching Adrian Clem's UCLA offensive lineman film from a technique perspective. And I feel like Terry is stepping, similar to Clem, I feel like Terry is stepping into, at Oregon, a more a more talented environment, a more healthy and functional environment, and one in which, you know, he's probably going to have more opportunities to flourish than he did at his last stop. So,
That's good to hear. I'm really looking forward to that article tomorrow.
Well, we'll be going up at 7 a.m.
I'll be awake.
Well, very good. All right, I think that'll do it for us this week. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for us?
No, not really. It's not April 29th yet, but it is Pac-12 tournament week, so go Ducks. Do it to it. Make a run.
And hey, you can go watch a baseball game. The weather may or may not be cooperative. The scorekeeper may or may not have a clever thing to say about it. But regardless of what the rain does at PK Park, it never rains on this podcast.